from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Virtual reality has been touted as a technology that could change everything from teleconferencing to treatment of PTSD. Jeremy Bailenson, who is the director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford, will join us to discuss his new book, Experience on Demand, which explores both the promises and the dangers of virtual reality, or VR.
We make a mistake where we talk about VR as a medium. The brain tends to treat the experience as if it were real.
The future of virtual reality, next, after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Virtual reality is supposed to fully immerse a user in an alternate reality, a football field, a precarious cliff, or an exotic locale. The technology could significantly change everything from teleconferencing to treating phobias, and Stanford professor Jeremy Bailenson predicts that within 5 years, virtual reality will be almost indistinguishable from real life. He joins us in studio this hour to talk about his new book, Experience on Demand, and the promises and dangers of an increasingly realistic virtual reality. Welcome to the program. Good to have you back.
I couldn't be happier to be here. Thanks, Michael.
Well, let's talk about the good things first. I mean, there are a lot of perils here, a lot of dangers down the road, but a lot of things in terms of big claims about making us better and actually enhancing our sense of empathy and imagination, all the things that we all celebrate and want. You begin your book actually by kind of showing the ropes to Mark Zuckerberg. He had a certain concerted interest in, one would assume, in virtual reality.
Mark came to visit us in 2014, and we gave him about a two-hour-long demo where he experienced VR, but we talked about the applications we'll talk about today: communication, entertainment, training, prejudice reduction, he left. And 2 weeks later, Zuckerberg shocked the world by buying this tiny little company called Oculus that we now know he paid $3 billion for it. And this sets off a series of events around the world that really brings VR back to the forefront, and one of the reasons I get to be here talking to you today.
Well, it is in the forefront, and it presents a lot of challenges, as we said, but a lot of exciting things, too. Zuckerberg did what our own NPR Lulu Garcia-Navarro did. He kind of walked the plank, so to speak. Huh?
He was a good sport. He did a bunch of demos, and we talked about productivity. We talked about empathy. He wore the, you know, when we think about VR today, these helmets, they're light and fluffy. They weigh about half a pound. He wore our NVIS, is the name of the company, head mounted display. It weighs about 5 pounds. He was in there for about 45 minutes, so it's he's got a strong neck.
Well, when you're on, I mentioned Lulu, for example, because she was on top of the Empire State Building pretty much. I mean, literally there. Your brain is responding like you're literally there, not virtually there. And in every way, you have a response that suggests, well, in her case, it was terror, really, because you're walking off of this building, literally, in your head.
The name of the book is Experience on Demand, and the reason is our research shows that the brain tends to treat a VR demo as an experience. And Lulu, who was, let's say, first that she was the best hockey player I've ever seen. She became a goalie in Madison Square Garden and went 6 for 6 in blocking pucks. So Lulu was amazing as a hockey player. Lulu, when she did the plank, which is you look down and there's this big drop and you've got to walk on this precarious plank, she responded in a way that I would describe as sane. Her brain said, huh, that is a long drop. I'm not going to step out onto that and step off this plank, because if you think about human evolution, we've been doing this for quite some time. That is evolving. VR is very new, and our brains have not really come to grips with this. If you step forward and the world changes accordingly, if all of the scene responds to your body movements the same way it has for hundreds of thousands of years in the real world, the brain doesn't know what to do with that.
The brain also doesn't want to do a lot of other things that are possible in this world of virtual reality, as you introduce us to it. On the other hand, you know, I think about things like swimming with sharks or flying above a city as sort of game-like, exciting things, standing on the surface of Mars. I mean, there's no end to the things you can inhabit, because you can even inhabit other bodies. You can have these avatars. But let's talk more about the positive things in terms of, for example, ameliorating problems related to PTSD or learning more about climate change. These are big deals.
VR can let you do the impossible. And what my lab focuses on at Stanford is creating these experiences that you can't do in the real world. So in terms of climate change, why is it that lawmakers who have seen climate change devastate their districts, for example, Florida, those lawmakers are worried about climate change and support policy to deal with climate change now because they have, in the words of Dr. Jane Lubchenco, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration under President Obama, they have a direct experience. That experience changes us. Virtual reality can give you an experience so you can see what your city will look like 20 years from now. You can see how the coastlines have changed, how the bottoms of the oceans have changed. You can have direct experience to understand viscerally and experientially that climate change is real.
And you can get in someone else's skin. You can indeed experience what it's like to be black, or you can, if you're a male, a female, female, a male. These are really brave new world stuff.
Since the year 2003, we've been running experiments that leverage what's called body transfer, to quote the neuroscientist. And this is an idea where you walk up to a virtual mirror and you're moving in the physical world. You move your arm and you see your avatar, your virtual representation, move in the mirror. After about 4 minutes of moving your body physically and seeing that mirror image update, the brain treats that mirror image as an extension of yourself. It really feels like that mirror image is you. Then what we do is we hit a button and we change your skin color. We change your age. We change your gender, and you experience what it's like to become someone else. In the next phase of the experiments, we network in a second person into VR, and so you're wearing this other person's body, and you experience prejudice firsthand. This person walks up to you, says some bad things about your identity, could be your gender, your race, threatens you physically, and you get to walk a mile in someone else's shoes and experience what it's like to be someone else. And what we describe in Chapter 3 of the book is I go through every single study that's been done in the realm of VR empathy. And Michael, the answer is it's not a magic tool. It doesn't solve the world's problems. But when you compare it to control conditions like role-playing or reading about case studies, in general, what the dozens of studies have shown is VR tends to outperform those control conditions.
And expands consciousness, which is really important. And all this, and we're talking, by the way, with Jeremy Bailenson, who is founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. His new book is Experience on Demand: What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. And actually, I was wondering in reading your book, the first chapter is all about quarterbacks. You think that they were using this in the Super Bowl? I mean, virtual reality could make you kind of train in better ways. Could have maybe helped Tom Brady be a better sport. He could have shaken the hand of his opponent quarterback. But, I mean, the whole thing about what quarterbacks can do is really almost infinite.
So in terms of the Super Bowl, I'm going to say no comment. Some teams don't like when we talk about virtuality. But in terms of the NFC Championship games, one of our biggest users this season was Case Keenum, who used virtual reality over 2,600 times to practice decision-making as a quarterback. So a quarterback goes to the line of scrimmage, and before the ball snapped, he's got to look around, recognize a pattern, which is that a blitz package or some strange defense that he hasn't seen, and then decide if he's going to change the play at the line of scrimmage or move a running back to pick up a block. And what he's got to do very quickly under intense situations with everybody screaming at him is recognize that pattern and make the decision. And Case Keenum got twice as many virtual snaps this past season as he did actual ones. And we didn't reduce the number of actual snaps he took. He just got extra mental rehearsal. And you know, it was a nice tool for him to use.
I wonder if it's a better tool to have a deflated football. No, scratch that. Let me ask you, though, about some of the perils. I mean, there are extraordinary number of ways that virtual reality can be used for fun and for profit and presumably for enhancements of life, even talking about empathy again and imagination. But, you've said yourself in the book, physical, mental, cultural perils and pitfalls. And some of them are not just eye strain or motion sickness. Let's talk about them.
Well, I'm really glad you're bringing this up. The book was reviewed in the New York Times, and for some reason they chose to ignore all the work that I did talking about the downsides. And I guess I was criticized for being an optimist, which I can live with, but I think it's critical to talk about the downsides. And when we talk about VR, the downsides are, first thing you have is distraction. So there was a man who passed away in Russia in December. He was playing a VR video game. He fell through a plate glass table and he bled to death. This was reported by the Moscow News. Thankfully, that's a small case. We haven't heard of many of those. But as we know, smartphone distraction causes many deaths. And, you know, VR is probably going to be the same way. And what I'm doing, one of the reasons I'm writing this book, so I'm going on a tour where I talk not just to, you know, to bookstores, but I'm talking to the companies that make VR, and I'm begging them to put in their hardware safety issues. So I was at a large tech company yesterday, and I said, please, because all the hardware engineers were in the room, can you please make it so VR does not work in a moving car? Just make it so it won't work. You can't use VR when you're in a moving car. So distraction is one of them.
And what about ethical dangers?
Ethical dangers. So my lab has been funded by the U.S. military for over a decade, and I'm proud to make my soldier. I'm proud to do research that helps our soldiers get better at their job. I think that's an obligation we have as citizens, and I'm thrilled to do that. You know, when you think about violence and video games, we think about desensitization, and we could talk about that, but my larger concern with VR is skill learning. So what we've learned with the quarterbacks is that VR is a tool that helps quarterbacks get better at their job physically and other athletes. And one concern I have is that the most amazing training simulations that teach people how to do combat, when this comes into the hands of citizens, that's something that makes me think twice and that I think about.
Well, you know, you look at I mean, we're mentioning Zuckerberg, for example. He never would have dreamed of some of the nefarious uses, let's say, of Facebook and the way Facebook was used, not only in the election and so forth, but used by extremists and sending out words and getting people to appear in Charlottesville, all the rest of those kinds of things. I mean, there's a Pandora's box side to this, really.
There is. It's critical to try to get out in front of this. And as I said, I'm talking to the people who are thinking about the parameters, both hardware, software, policies, and I can promise you that if there's a silver lining of what the conversation about social media in the last few months, it's that on the VR side, I believe that the decision makers and companies are taking these downsides more seriously.
I remember what a shrink once told me, every silver lining has a cloud. You can indeed look at life that way, but obviously you choose not to, and I do as well. But you make an interesting analogy at one point when Wozniak and Jobs were working on Apple II. Let's talk about that.
You never know what it's going to be used for. And with VR, what's fascinating to me, so I've been in the VR field since 1999. And when I talk to my colleagues, the old guys and the old women who are doing this work, we didn't really think about journalism. We didn't really think about film, and we didn't really think about video games. So if you think about the public perception of what VR is good for, you know, the New York Times all in on their 360 video, which they did last year. Video games, of course, is where a lot of the press is going. When we were originally thinking about VR and what it would be used for, you know, when I first started doing this, the systems cost more than most homes did. It required a dedicated room that was bigger than most garages. You had to have at least one technician on site to make sure that it runs. You know, we used to think about it as an MRI machine. And we did think that at some point the hardware would get cheaper and easier to use. But most of my colleagues, we weren't thinking about video games, and we certainly weren't thinking about telling news stories.
I remember when we started talking about the internet and all the superhighway and, you know, all these things that were going to open up bountifully and everything. I think for many years, and probably still, the main uses of the internet, games and pornography. One has to take that into kind of sobering consideration. But also, when I mentioned when you were on NPR with Lulu Garcia Navarro, there was a game involving shooting, and you declined because, well, why did you decline?
Look, part of it is there's cameras on me, and I don't shoot guns, and I didn't want to do it in VR. I mean, the standard that's evolving as I think through, and it's an evolution, Michael. I mean, conversations like this will additionally help me shape my thinking that we're having today. But the standard that I'm setting for my friends and family is VR is great for the things you cannot do in the real world. It was invented for that. Do the impossible. What it's not great for are things that you wouldn't do in the real world. So if you did it in the real world, you'd have trouble sleeping that night. You'd feel bad about yourself. You couldn't look your parents or your spouse in the eye. I don't think you should do those in VR because the brain tends to treat VR a little bit differently than other media. We're using our body to behave. It's perceptually real. It stays with us, and we get memory for these.
But the danger is, I think, that these immersive experiences are increasing exponentially, and what the imagination, particularly the darker sides of the imagination, can conceive is usually beyond, let's say, your thoughts or my thoughts in any reasonable way.
You know, the U.S. Supreme Court in 2011 ruled that intensely violent video games are art and free speech. And I fully support free speech, and I'm not a fan of regulating free speech at all. Justice Alito, he wrote a concurring opinion, which basically said, it's true that it's free speech, but we need to think about as games become VR, as they get more immersive, there's something a little different about that. And again, I want our listeners to know that I'm not trying to regulate content, and I'm a firm believer of free speech. But when I talk to my friends and family and they ask me, well, what should and shouldn't I do in VR? My answer is pretty clear. If it's not something you're willing to do in the real world, you should probably politely decline that box of VR that somebody handed you.
Well, what about the high cost of VR? I mean, it's still pretty expensive, and the fact of the matter is it's probably, like everything else, going to go down. But what do you foresee?
It's, you know, I can't, when you say that sentence, it's hard for me to even fathom what you're saying, because the first VR grant that I wrote, the computers to run the VR cost six figures. We had to use, intense workstations. So
talking about everyday use pretty much, though.
Yeah, but, you know, people spend a couple $100 on video game systems. And right now, you know, the HTC Vive costs about $400. The Oculus Rift costs about $400. Samsung Gear, about $100. And to me, we're at a scale now where everyday users can't afford the hardware. The reason it hasn't taken off in the way that some people predicted it would is mostly because the content. There's just not much there to do that is that compelling right now.
I think you make the analogy to it's coming at us like a freight train, and that's the image that certainly conforms to my own thoughts here. And you don't want necessarily to in any way abridge free speech, but what about regulation? We don't understand where this is going, this freight train.
You know, I'm not a lawmaker, and my job is when I don't understand something, I ask experts. And one of the people that I talk to is Tom Wheeler, the former FCC chairman, the champion of net neutrality. And I'm talking to him about it. You know, I recently did a briefing at the U.S. Senate where we showed congresswomen and congressmen and senators VR and had some conversations. So, you know, I'm in listening mode and talking to people mode. You know, in the current administration, I can say in the previous administration, there were some folks that we were talking to. So President Obama came to Stanford and he met with one of my graduate students and he did one of these empathy demos, he talked about one of these empathy demos with her. He didn't put the helmet on. Let me clear that up. So he talked to my graduate student, Caitlin. We talked about empathy and he made a joke. He said, well, we should try to use that on Congress. And that was his joke. But the current administration, we're not, there's no conversations as far as I know.
Isn't there also there may be shrinking cost? In fact, you spoke about it dramatically from when you started, but there's also maybe a gap that's shrinking as well between the real and the virtual.
It's getting better every day, and you know, I get to try out all the new toys because people come to Stanford and they want to show me the new
stuff.
So
how real is this thing going to be?
It's Jaron Lanier, who I know you had on the show recently and who's one of my academic heroes and just a brilliant, amazing guy. There's a quote that he says that his favorite part about doing VR is when he takes the helmet off and sees how amazing the real world is with all the colors and all the touches and the sounds and the smells. And, you know, we are... You know, I know I might have said at some point in 5 years in the book, and in 5 years from a vision and an auditory standpoint, it's going to be quite good. You know, probably still distinguishable, but, you know, every month I'm stunned. Somebody comes to the lab and they show me something that I thought was 5 years away. So it's accelerating drastically.
We're talking about virtual reality with Jeremy Baylinson. He's founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford, and his new book is called Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. And I know there are many of you who have questions and perhaps want to weigh in here on some of the bigger questions that I've tried to raise about what's down the road here and what may be dangerous, as well as what's exciting to you. You know, we're talking about both, really, and both have to come into the conversation. Concerns you have, questions you have, thoughts you have are welcome. Let me give you a toll-free number, and you can join us right now. Number to call is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program and thoughts you might have, as well as simply feel free to join our conversation. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email any thoughts or questions, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do want to get you involved in this, so please feel free to do so in an interactive way. This is in some ways really an entirely new medium, isn't it?
You know,
I mean, it's been around for a while, but things keep changing so quickly. And there's, we were talking about the volatility of the stock market in the last hour. This is in some ways even more volatile.
You know, I teach in a department of communication, and we've got some cultural historians in my department, and they'll argue with me on this claim. They'll say, no, there's nothing new. And everybody always says that. But I really feel this isn't just adding HD to TV or color to an image. This is the fact that you're using your body. In psychology, we call this embodied cognition, which is that we know the mind is in the brain, but it turns out how you move your body, it changes attitudes, cognition, and VR is all about the body. And it's a very different medium when the world reacts to movement.
Well, getting some responses, let me read one from Vern here, who says, it's just a screen on your face and a hefty one at that. How is that magical? To want to put a screen immediately between yourself and the world is poignant expression of our modern alienation.
Well, I love the comment. And Vern, so I'm not a VR evangelist. I don't play video games. I don't have a Facebook account. I do a lot of stuff outside. In my lab, we've got a 20-minute rule, which is that use VR for these really intense experiences. Use them for things that are going to change the way you think about yourself and others. And then take it off. Go outside. Use it every couple of days. It's not, you know, where I clash with some of the big tech companies is that their models are based on people using VR often. But in my 20 years of doing this work, a little bit of VR goes a long way, and it's really designed for these really intense experiences that are short, and then you take it off and go on your way. But in terms of the magic, if you haven't tried it, you know, it's Chris Milk says talking about VR is like dancing about architecture. It's hard to talk about.
Well, here's some testament. A listener writes, Stanford Psych helped me overcome a severe fear of flying with VR. I couldn't be more grateful. Hashtag VR for everyone.
The clinical uses of VR, we can talk about some amazing work by my colleague Kim Bullock that's helping people overcome different types of disorders with movement disorders by having them practice physical therapy. Kids with chronic regional pain syndrome, my colleague Brenda Goliano at Stanford, we've been using VR to help kids do their physical therapy who've got CRPS, and it really helps motivate them to get that work done, gives them what we call self-efficacy, the belief they can do it.
And more is being used not only psychologically, clinically, but medically. In fact, Laura says, is anyone using VR to work with children with autism to help them practice social skills?
There are one of the most frustrating parts of my life in VR is there's probably 15 to 20 academic studies that shows that VR can help kids who have autism. I get emails from parents, as well they should, ask me, well, when can I use this? And I just don't know of products out there that you can download right now or clinicians who have dedicated their space to it. So it's this gaping, you know, disconnect where the academic research, we know, for example, I've published a study with my colleague Peter Mundy from UC Davis that shows that you can use VR for kids who have autism to train things like eye contact and different social skills. And there's academic research out there. I just don't know of products that parents can use now.
Well, a lot of ethical questions here, a lot of concerns, but also a lot of uses, games, movies, life-altering experiences. You may want to indeed add your voice here, and you can do so by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Particularly like to hear from some of you who have had either good or bad experiences with virtual reality or have some thoughts about where it rests in our future. We're talking to Jeremy Bailenson, and again, he's founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford, and the author of Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jeremy Bailenson. He's here with us in studio, author of a new book called Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. And the reality is that it feels real, and your brain thinks it's real in so many cases. And there are all kinds of uses for it. I'm thinking about travel for those who can't afford it, or just maybe establishing any kind of environmental model you want that you can even imagine, but also perils and ethical concerns and concerns about what ought to be regulated and, for that matter, trouncing on possible free enterprise and the like. Let me go to our callers, but a tweet from Sarah, an important question. What about addiction? How addictive is VR? What do we know, Jeremy?
What we know is almost nothing. You know, the cigarette companies, The big tobacco companies used to be able to say with a straight face, there's never been a controlled study that randomly signs a large sample of people to smoke two packs a day for 30 years. So we don't have any data about what smoking does to cancer. And VR addiction is fairly similar. No scientist I know of wants to spend her day job of forcing people to be in VR for 10 hours a day. So what we do know is it's extremely compelling. Virtual reality is. And we do know certainly that the smartphone itself has got addictive qualities. So
if it feels good, it can be addictive. I think there's a good rule of law or rule of living, isn't it?
You and I are speaking the same language here. So I worry about it. It's one of the reasons we've got this 20-minute rule. I mean, when social networking feels like the best party you've ever been to, when online gambling feels like you're in Vegas, when pornography feels like actual sex, how does that affect people?
We continue to muse about that. Let's go to our callers. And Dan, we begin with you. Dan, you're on the air.
Good morning. My question is a straightforward one. What do you think that we are all, what do you think about the idea that, of course, we're already inside of an all of virtual reality? If it's possible that it can become so real that you can't distinguish the difference, then I'm sure your guest is familiar. There are five assumptions that we're already in one, and the odds are that it's already been created, and we're the one that's not the real one.
Yeah, I love the thought. I'm just going to be honest with you. The question's a bit above my pay grade, and this idea that we're all in a simulation, I love reading about it, but I don't have any additional insights.
Does it feel that way to you, Dan?
All right. Hello?
Yeah, Dan, I want to know, does it feel that way to you?
Well, no, because I took philosophy in college, so anyone who's
you can tell, yeah.
Knows about the three-minute universe concept and skepticism, this is not an earth-shattering idea. I think it's funny how people in the area, because there's so many programmers, love to bandy this idea about. But it's not falsifiable, so there's not really much to be done there.
Then that's why I didn't comment, Dennis, because I can't test it in the lab, then I shouldn't try to speak about it on the air.
Well, glad to hear it. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to hear from you, Dan. Thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Rob. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I'm going to be another cloud in the silver lining. Three things. One is the idea of fraud. You know, we'll be people just get so real that people won't be able to distinguish it when it comes to crimes, when it comes to all kinds of other things, because we can't tell sometimes if something's been photoshopped or not. Another thing is the idea that it may diminish actual real experiences. People will choose to do virtual reality instead of going outside. You know, you talked about your rule about having to go outside after a while. Well, you know, in reality, people may choose to just do virtual reality because it's easier and get kind of lazy. And what about diminishing real experiences like going on safari in Africa? Will places like that in a natural world become not as valuable, and people won't care if all these animals go extinct because we can just watch them on VR? And is this going to really, you know, you talked about addiction. Kids are watching video games like crazy. And the way things get commercialized, you know, you can say it's great to have a rule that you need to go outside, but this stuff is going to be completely addictive to kids. And then developmentally, it just kind of scares me.
Well, first, let me thank you. All three of your points are things that, you know, I'm not going to disagree with and I think about every day. So let me start with the kids. I'm literally in the car ride up here. I was put the finishing touches on a report that I'm writing with Common Sense Media, which is what parents need to know about VR and their kids. And, you know, it's a common sense approach to really, you know, help parents understand the medium. And so I have written that report and we'll be able to share that with you soon. On the, you know, the virtual nature idea is one that fascinates me. So, you know, I spend a lot of time using VR to teach about conservation. For example, if somebody cuts down a virtual tree because of their paper use, they get this connection that paper comes from trees and it changes their paper use later on. But this idea of, if we build a virtual safari, it's going to be better than the actual thing. You're always going to see animals doing the four F's: feeding, fleeing, fighting, and mating, right? Animals, they're going to be right in your face, and they're going to be it's going to be the best experience you've ever had because you're not looking at them through glass or from a Jeep. You get to walk right up to them and if you want, share body space. And so on the one hand, that's wonderful because when we're 11 billion people, you're not going to be able to all go to a safari in Africa. We're not going to be able to sustain that. On the other hand, when you've got real nature and and virtual nature, who gets to go see the real nature? Is it only the wealthy? And there's all sorts of strange kind of ways to kind of take that through.
Yeah, but you could see almost in a kind of long trajectory how people would say, well, you know, I was going to go to Africa, but it'd be easier to put on my virtual reality and go there that way. It also could be, you know, really pretty harmful to tourist trade, for example, and people getting off and going and experiencing things in the real world as far as travel and all.
Agreed. I flew to Borneo and I gave a talk to Borneo, who obviously makes a living of people coming to see animals in Borneo. It's the only place you can see the orangutans in their native habitat. And I talked to the lawmakers of Borneo of this exact issue, which is, should we use VR to encourage people so they can see how amazing it is here? But then when you think it through, at some point, maybe people don't actually want to make the journey. Now, I will say one of the functions of zoos is conservation, just keeping the animals, you know, safe and studied and healthy. And if it comes to some world where zoos no longer function for spectators, it's more about the scientists and the conservation, that's, you know, it's not something that, you know, that may be one solution.
Well, here's a caller more positive about VR. Catherine, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious to hear how you draw the line between exposure therapy and immersive trauma. I played a VR game known as Arizona Sunshine. It still gives me nightmares. It's a game where you have zombies blitzing you. And even thinking about it, like, I'm kind of shaking a little bit because it was a traumatic experience. So how do you draw the line between something that's beneficial?
Like, here I thought you were a positive VR call.
You know, I'm delighted with these comments. Thank you for it. So first off, you know, in Chapter 6, we write about treating PTSD. And Skip Rizzo and Joanne DeFiti, the two heroes that I follow, the two therapists that do this work, they would never, ever ask anyone to go into VR for cognitive exposure therapy without a therapist there. This should not be done on the fly in living rooms. And you want to be with a therapist who can take you through this journey in a clinical way. Onto your experience, I'm sorry that you're shaking, and this is why I don't do first-person shooters in VR. It's not a way I want to spend my time. And really, one of the reasons I write this book, which is, you know, video games work just fine now, and you can do things with this level of separation when you're in VR and you're doing murder with your hands and getting assaulted by zombies and other creatures. It's a little different. And, you know, again, I'm all for free speech. When my friends and family ask me, I don't want them to do these games.
Yeah, maybe stay away from the zombies, Catherine. That might be the
last. It's a good rule of life, actually.
Thank you for the call. Even the living ones. Actually, here's Nance who tweets, I can't use VR. I get motion sick. I've tried. Any improvement on that?
So if you get motion sick in VR, it's typically because of one of two reasons. One is the system either has lag, which is you move your body and the world responds a little bit late, and the technology should be mostly solved on that. The second reason, and one that just is quite frustrating to me, is that some content creators do things to make you sick. So when you see movement and your body's not moving, you've got a dissociation between what's called optic flow, what your eyes see, and vestibular cues, what your inner ear tells you. So when you come to my lab and do VR, you don't see movement in the scene unless you're walking. And so if you get sick in VR, don't do any simulations where the camera's moving when you're not.
Is your lab open? People can come visit?
We run about two or three public tours each week. So send an email. There's a contact tab on my lab's website, and you can sign up there.
You want to give the website?
vhil.stanford.edu.
Jennifer says, how can you keep suggesting a 20-minute rule with a straight face when you know people won't follow this?
Look, I run a VR lab. I have the best VR on the planet, and I've never done it for more than 20 minutes. So I do realize I'm an outlier, but it's just, you know, wearing that helmet for 20 minutes, it's just enough for me. So I've completely acknowledged that there's going to be a subset of people that do overuse. But, you know, I
think it'd be especially hard with kids. You know, you see you have a 20-minute limit on this, and then they're going to bed and they have their helmet and they take it to bed with them like they now take their digital devices. This is a whole problem for parents.
I'm doing a tour through the valley talking to the big tech companies, and I'm saying, imagine you got to redo things that we didn't do right with smartphones and with social media and tablets with kids. You are now in the infancy. Let's think about this, and let's, from a company standpoint and from a, you know, a community leader standpoint, let's think about this now before that happens. So I'm acknowledging that kids are going to, of course, they're going to want to do this. And one of the reasons I'm writing this Common Sense Media Report is I want to give parents really thoughtful advice on things that they can do to prevent that.
Our guest is Jeremy Bailenson, and his book is Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. We'll take some more calls here, but just a quick comment from Bill, who says, just when I thought our society could not be less emotionally isolated, along comes VR. I can't wait to go to a restaurant full of single men wearing VR headgear having dinner with their perfect mate. I can hear it now. Waiter, there's a virtual fly in my soup. Here's a call from Mountain View. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to see how far we are from using virtual reality in programming robotics in terms of, say, like kind of remote distributed. So if you were to, you know, teach a robot right now using lines of code, but for, say, in the future, we can teach it to move its arms and cook us eggs in the morning. Or if you had like a celebrity chef in his kitchen, but you have robots in like 50 different homes, and that one chef can do his movement once and make 50 people dinner. Or
a general question has to do with robots and ties to virtual reality, Jeremy.
So the main innovation I'm seeing there's a field in computer science called human-robot interaction, HRI, and we're basically studying what's the world going to be like when there's robots all over the place. What are the psychological issues around people and robots? Now, the problem is to build robots is super expensive, and to make them move in certain ways, to animate them, we're limited by physics right now, and there needs to be more kind of hardware innovation. So there's a lot of people that use VR to simulate robots so that you can then understand how people interact with robots by putting them in VR to study the way that robots change the way you move, the way that things you'd like to say or not say in front of robots. So VR simulates robots really well right now.
When we talk about VR and the dangers and concerns and anxieties, I come back to children because there's really not a lot that we know about. We know the brain is very elastic and has a lot of elasticity, but we don't necessarily know what's happening in neural pathways. I've said this before on the air, and I'm kind of tired of saying it, but, you know, kids are looking at these devices all the time, and this, if anything, exacerbates that, it would seem.
So agreed that we know next to nothing about VR in kids. Jackie Bailey, my PhD student who just graduated, she's now a professor at the University of Texas. She's dedicated her career to studying kids in VR, and we did a large project funded by Sesame Workshop where we had kids come in and meet Grover and studied. Obviously, we didn't study any changes in brain patterns, but certainly studied the...
But those are happening, aren't they? I mean, you talk about the brain being so... It's so real that it has to be a change that's taking place, some kind of transformation.
You know, my neuroscientist colleagues, they like to remind me that everything causes brain changes, whether you're eating a pizza or sprinting down a field. Certainly media use is in that bucket.
Yeah, we're talking about big brain changes, though. I mean, if children are using virtual stuff all the time, there has to be a link. There has to be a connection.
So it's my hope that kids don't use VR all the time. But, Michael, in terms of general media use, I can't claim to you that VR is so powerful it can make us less prejudiced and not claim there's not changes going on. So I'm hearing you.
Well, here's from some more callers. Supra, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. So my question is, right now, as I see it, VR is primarily in two senses, right? You hear and you see. Also, maybe in third sense, where you are able to experience in terms of movement. So is there any work or what is your view on actually expanding it to all the five senses of, you know, touch, smell, feel kind of thing?
So we just published our donut study. And this was years in the making. It came out about a week ago in a journal called Presence. And the big idea here is, imagine that you're eating a vegan patty, but it looks, smells, and feels like the best hamburger you've ever eaten. We've just solved climate change and the obesity epidemic if we can cause food to taste differently. So the donut study, we had subjects, half of our subjects felt a donut in their hand virtually. We put a plastic donut in their hand. Half of our subjects smelled the donut. We had donut scent piped into their nose. All of them saw the donut that's sitting in their hand. So subjects in this experience, they looked down in VR, they moved their arm, and they saw a donut sitting in there. And now remember, half of them felt the donut, the other half didn't. Half of them smelled the donut, the other half didn't. And we had two predictions going in, because it's very preliminary work. So let's just be clear about that. Very preliminary early pilot study, about 100 subjects. The two predictions were, one was satiation, that this donut eating experience in VR was going to make you not want to eat donuts later on. The second was what we call priming, which is that you're going to get reminded of donuts and that you're going to immediately run out and eat more donuts. After this experience, we had subjects do a taste test where there are physical donuts in the lab, and we measured how many donuts they ate. And what we found was preliminary support for the satiation hypothesis, that feeling the donut in your hand and smelling it caused people to eat fewer donuts compared to not feeling it or not smelling it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And there's definitely a route there to much more research, obviously, huh? We'll go to much more calls, as many as we can get. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask your guest something. If he's tried an experiment where he's hooked somebody up to one of these systems, not turned it on, let them go to sleep, get into REM and dreaming, and then turn it on and gently nudge them to wake them, and did they realize they were awake, or were they, did they think they were still dreaming? What was their reaction to that?
So I love the idea, and what the caller and what I want everyone to understand is that in the history of VR, there's been maybe 15 good scholars that have dedicated their career to studying the psychology of it. And if the world needs 10,000 studies to really understand how VR affects people, we've only done a tenth, a 20th of that, not even close. So it's a great idea to study how sleep interacts with VR, but we just don't have data on it.
Let me thank the caller. I'm looking at a comment here from a listener who says, listening to the author reminds me of hearing Timothy Leary discussing LSD in the 1960s. How is VR similar and different? Well, it doesn't necessarily make you want to tune in and drop out, but I'm not sure you see any analogies there to psychedelics.
I just recently wrote an article. I posted it on Slate. It was 8 ways to stay safe in VR. And one of my rules was let's leave the substances out of it. VR is mind expanding enough.
Well, and somebody asked about the 5 senses. You got any questions about the 6th sense in VR?
You know, so one of the things we can do in VR, and this is some of our listeners may think of this as the downside. VR, in addition, if you think about smartphones, you can measure what people are saying, where they are via GPS. In order to make VR work, you have to track body language. You've got to track where people are looking, where they're standing, what their posture is, their history of movement. 90 frames a second, you get the XYZ pitch, yaw, and roll of the head, the hands. It's a lot of data. So if someone's in VR for 10 minutes, the file gets so big on their body movement, you can't even open it in Excel. We've run studies, in particular my former grad student Andrew Stevenson Wan, who's now a professor at Cornell, showing that you can use the body language, the body movement that you can track in VR can predict, for example, how anxious you are when you're doing public speaking. It can predict how much you're going to learn. So if you measure people's body language with VR systems while they're getting an online instruction and then do machine learning to try to predict how well they do on the test, your body language is tracked from VR, can predict how much you've learned during instruction. I could go on with others in the list, but in terms of a sixth sense, this is the first time in history we've had such an accurate and large measurement of body language, and that is like a sixth sense.
I'm getting word that the Slate article is now online on our website, kqed.org, and let's go to another caller, and let's go, Matthew, to you. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks, guys. So I read a book by Jane F. Tufekci called Twitter and Tear Gas, and it was talking about the dangers of social media and the way that it can be so easily manipulated. VR is like the atom bomb of virtual technology in terms of its power to indoctrinate brainwash. And you have through this technology the autocrat's wet dream. You can create soldiers that are like deeply ideologically motivated to the use of VR. And for that matter, prison reform. At some point, do people have a right to their own their own experience, and safeguarding their own experience? Can they be immersed against their will into VR? And so what I'm asking, I guess, about in general, have you anticipated some of the dystopian possibilities that could arise from the use of VR? And furthermore, do you feel like an inherent sense of responsibility to create like immediate censure against the use of technology and industry standards that can prevent the same kind of things that have happened on social media to happen in VR? Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew.
So thanks for the question. You know, most VR scientists I know of are heavy science fiction readers, and we're really aware of the dystopian nightmares that William Gibson presents in Neuromancer and, even the new movie coming out, Ready Player One. It's not really a fun world to live in. So certainly aware of those ideas. All I can do is I can come on shows like this, try to talk to people about the dangers, go and talk to the CEOs of these big companies, which I do fairly often, and urge them to think about issues of safety. One interesting note on prison reform, there's a company called Ensenya, and Ensenya is helping prisoners who are about to get released, people that have been in there for about 20 years, experience what it's going to be like when they get out. So, things they haven't had before, like self-checkout at a supermarket or how to sort their laundry in new laundromats. And it's actually a neat tool to help prisoners kind of pre-adjust to their life once they leave.
And let me thank Matthew for his call. And here's Jonathan, who writes, wants to know about basic mechanics of VR. Could you please have your guests explain more about the basic effects of actual use for the uninitiated body motion in space, head movement, hand motion, what you see, etc.
In the physical world, if you walk closer to an object, it gets bigger. If you turn your head towards a sound, it gets louder. And that's how humans have existed for forever, which is there's a physical action and a perceptual response to that physical movement. VR has to do three things technologically: track, render, and display. Track is a fancy word for measuring your movement. If we're going to know that you've moved, say, a meter forward, the cameras have to measure that you've walked forward. You then render, that is, redraw the scene from the new position. So objects get bigger, sounds get louder, and then you've got to do what's called display, which is send sounds to the ears and send new images to the eye. So to sum up, you walk around in the physical world, sensors measure that you've moved, we redraw the appropriate sensory stimuli for that new location, sight, sound, touch, sometimes smell, and then you replace the senses.
And that happens immediately?
90 frames a second is what the current industry standard is, and at a latency of about 15 milliseconds, meaning when you move, it only takes that long to get the sensory update, which is just, you know, a stunning achievement technologically.
Well, a lot of this is stunning, but a lot of it's frightening, too.
Look, that's why we're here. Let's talk about it.
Well, we are continuing to talk about it, talking with Jeremy Bailenson, who is founding director of Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. His new book is Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me get another caller on here. Let me go to Mill Valley and welcome Sandy. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. Sorry. Anyhow, I'm trying to help my friend's daughter, who is 21 years old, and she has such bad PTSD. She can't go to school. She can't work. She did graduate high school, but basically she's trapped in her mother's apartment. She basically can't engage with people at any level. Is there something with the virtual reality that might be able to help this young woman who lives on the peninsula?
I'm sorry she's going through that, but Jeremy, there is some results with PTSD, isn't there?
So I'm devastated to hear that. I'm sorry. There is great science here. That's the good news. There's two people in particular I talk about in the book. One is Skip Rizzo at the University of Southern California, and he uses VR to help veterans do cognitive exposure therapy. The other is Joanne DeFiti at Cornell in New York City. And, for example, she does a lot of work with first responders, for example, after 9/11. And, you know, in the PTSD realm, you know, the way that you do cognitive exposure therapy is that you need to mentally bring someone back so that you can give them coping strategies and you can try to unravel some of this trauma. The problem is if you've had trauma, you don't want to go back. And when you try to imagine it, it's brutal and you don't want to do it. So virtual reality, when guided by a therapist, and I can't say that strongly enough, is a really helpful tool, because for those that don't want to go back, the therapist has an extra tool to help that patient go back to that spot and to deliver the right therapy. So Skip Rizzo at USC, Joanne DeFiti at Cornell. And again, I'm sorry.
I hope we can get her some help. Sandy, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Appreciate your calling on her behalf. And we'll get another caller on. That's Deepak from Berkeley. Deepak, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about augmented reality. You've got information that's, you know, virtual, kind of integrated into the real world. This is potentially more stimulation than what you would get in virtual reality. How do you feel about that? Do you think there's a risk for distraction or overstimulation?
So for listeners, augmented reality, you're wearing a normal pair of glasses that you'd wear every day, and you overlay digital images so that, say, if there's a crowd of people physically, you could see name tags floating over all of their heads, and that's what augmented reality is.
We have a whole program on that that's in our archives, in fact, which I would mention if people want to know more about. But say a little bit about the difference between augmented reality for the person experiencing it as opposed to virtual reality.
So as an academic lab, we are all in on studying augmented reality this year and the years coming, because from a psychological standpoint, there's been, you know, probably 1,000 or 2 studies about virtual reality. In AR, there's studies about usability and perception, but there's not much work on, you know, what does the world look like when I'm talking to person A physically and then I see person B digitally and only I see that person and then that person, the digital person, walks through a wall. Like, how does that affect the way that humans walk around it? It's more an issue of multitasking. It's fundamentally different psychological issues behind AR than VR. What I can tell you is that we are thinking about this. We're running 4 studies as we speak in the lab. I've got 2 PhD students that do nothing but AR all day. We don't know that much. And as you know, I can tell from your question, industry is gung-ho on AR because unlike VR where, you know, you can necessarily you can only do it for, you know, 20 minutes a day in my lab, but it's not something you can do while you're walking around. The goal of AR is to be a companion, you know, that you have with you for much of the day. So that's, you know, it's something to think about.
You got a lot to do in your lab, don't you? A lot to think about.
It's, you know, when Zuckerberg bought Oculus, everything changed. I went from a professor that just got to do studies to, you know, Stanford, which I love working at Stanford, they encourage you to face outward and to work with organizations, and I'm trying.
Robert wants to know, could VR help people at the end of life?
One of my roles at Stanford, I work for the Stanford Center for Longevity, and the goal of the center is not to extend life, but given life is going to be long for many of us, and with each generation longer, how to, you know, prepare people for that extra 30 or 40 years we're going to have due to medical advances. And one of the things we've been talking about a lot and haven't done yet at the center is, you know, there are things that happen at the end of life, both for you and for loved ones that you're just not prepared for. And, you know, some type of the same way we train quarterbacks to do the right thing given a defense. And if there's an intense end-of-life event that requires you to make a decision, you know, let's have some practice.
Quick question from Patricia, who wants to know, has the movie industry been talking about VR? Technology and film has come a long way, but the best we can do is 3D. Is there interest that you know from Hollywood to involve VR so that the audience is actually part of the film?
There's an epic amount of interest, and in chapter 8 of the book, Stories in the Round, we talk about the challenges for storytelling, and the big challenge is think about film as fascism. The director holds the camera, and you have to look there. In VR, you can look anywhere, and so if there is some really important event, it's a sidelong glance from one character to the next, or it's you know, somebody reaching to their pocket, you could be staring at the wall, and you miss it.
One more quick question. Steve wants to know, what should I study in order to become a VR software developer? Algebra and geometry? And how about one book, The VR Bible for Programmers?
The VR Bible for Programmers? I just do online tutorials in Unity or Unreal or Wizard. That would be my advice there.
Jeremy, thank you for all your advice. Thank you for all the work you're doing. And onward and upward, we hope.
This has been awesome. Thank you, Michael. Always amazing to come on the show.
Jeremy Bailenson, founding director of Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford. His new book, Experience on Demand, and we are here with you on demand Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.